This conversation about hydroxychloroquine, a treatment we have been talking about from the very beginning, all around the world having success. Why is it so controversial? Why does it sound like this in that crappy news you're paying for?
Questions surrounding hydroxychloroquine are dizzying. Does the drug help prevent COVID-19? Can it be used as a treatment? Or is it killing sick patients?
The study by world-renowned infectious disease specialist Didier Raoult on treating 1,061 COVID-19 patients with hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin. When prescribed soon enough after the onset of symptoms, it leads to a more favorable outcome of COVID-19.
The use of the anti-malarial drugs has become political as President Donald Trump has touted hydroxychloroquine.
Major setback in the hopes that the drug hydroxychloroquine could be used as a possible treatment for coronavirus.
Several new studies, including one by the VA, say the drug may actually harm critically ill patients.
The FDA cited emerging evidence for reversing its earlier authorization to use the drug, as well as the related chloroquine in emergency situations.
The agency doesn't have enough evidence to support the drug's use in that setting. There's been a number of studies now that have come out that haven't shown a benefit. Some have shown a harm.
The hydroxychloroquine should have never made it to the FDA emergency use.
One study published in a medical journal had said hydroxychloroquine could increase a patient's chance of dying, but then the researchers later retracted their study.
A study so concerning, the World Health Organization paused a major clinical trial. The journal now acknowledges there were problems with that data, and top scientists are calling for a retraction.
It's unbelievable. That's not a study at all. They don't even list the dosages of hydroxychloroquine or azithromycin used.
The level of confusion out there in the public is not surprising because they're getting these crazy messages. I hope we get stronger and stronger oversight of the science, irrespective of what happens next.
There's no evidence that any drug actually reduces the mortality in patients who have COVID-19. And in fact, it's an urgent priority for all of us to do the needed studies, to do the randomized clinical trials.
Well, it's been 4 months on our show that we first brought to you a potential treatment for COVID-19, and that is hydroxychloroquine. In that episode, we discussed a French virologist named Dr. Didier Raoult, who came forward and started making incredible statements like, not only can we treat this respiratory illness, this is one of the easiest respiratory illnesses to treat. He said things like, anybody that denies hydroxychloroquine to a patient, that should be grounds for malpractice. Well, at the same time, and as we've continued to discuss this issue, there's really been two major names, two doctors around the world that have been in the spotlight around this discussion of hydroxychloroquine. One, of course, being Didier Raoult, and the other, a doctor out of New York named Dr. Vladimir Zelenko. Well, it is my honor and my pleasure to be joined right now by one of the luminaries in probably the most controversial discussion when it comes to this pandemic. I'm joined now by Dr. Vladimir Zelenko from New York. Dr. Zelenko, thank you so much for coming onto the High Wire.
Thank you so much for having me, though.
Now, we've been reporting on this, and this is, I have to say, one of the craziest medical stories I've ever covered, going all the way back to when I was a producer on the daytime talk show, The Doctors. We have watched this be celebrated as a potential treatment that could save the world, and then we watched, you know, Tony Fauci pushing back. We have seen Donald Trump say he's taking it. We've seen him attacked for saying things like that. We saw trials where it looked like people were dying. We've been told this doesn't work at all. And then there's conflicts on how those studies are working. We're probably going to get into a lot of that. But how does this all begin for you? How did you first get involved with using hydroxychloroquine on patients that were testing positive for COVID-19?
So it was necessity. I'm a primary care doctor, a family physician for a community of 35,000 people that live within a square mile of each other in upstate New York community, and the very high population density. And I knew that the virus was coming. We all knew, and there was no treatments available. The only thing that we were being told, you know, supportive care, give people fluids and Tylenol. If they developed shortness of breath, them to the hospital, they'll end up in a restroom and die. Essentially, that was all that we were offered. And I was trying to think of an intervention that could mitigate the course of the disease and prevent all those terrible pulmonary complications, which was the cause of all the death. So I started doing research. I looked around. Actually, there's a YouTube channel called MedCram, episode 34. Actually, I think probably saved the world, because that's where I initially saw the mechanism of action of hydroxychloroquine and zinc. And I started doing the research into different countries, like China and South Korea. They were the first to see the virus, and they were using hydroxychloroquine and zinc. And then, like you said, Didier Raoul from France, he was using azithromycin, the antibiotic, and hydroxychloroquine with some success. But they were all doing it in the lab or in patients that were very sick in the hospital. And my scope of practice is really in the outpatient setting, which is really the ideal place to treat any disease, because we don't want people to end up in the hospital.
Right.
So I have a solution for the respirator crisis, is preventing people from needing respirators. So right. I was looking for something to intervene. So I decided, let me combine the different approaches. And the reason why I felt comfortable doing this is these are old drugs. For example, hydroxychloroquine is 65 years old and has been used by millions of people. It's currently being used by millions of people for rheumatological diseases such as rheumatoid arthritis and lupus. It's used for malaria prophylaxis. These are drugs that I've been using for almost 2 decades with my patients. I was very comfortable. I knew its safety profile, and it's incredibly safe. We give it to pregnant women, we give it to children, given to nursing women. So I felt extremely comfortable using this drug. Azithromycin, one of the most common antibiotics used in the world. It's also safe in pregnancy. It's also safe for women who are nursing. So I also knew this drug very well. And zinc is a simple mineral. So I didn't see any problem taking all these FDA-approved medications and using them in a novel way. That as a physician, there's legal precedent for there who's licensed to take FDA-approved medication and use them off-label.
Right.
So I decided I'm going to try to intervene as quickly as possible to prevent patients from getting sick. And what I noticed was, by treating patients within the first 5 days of symptoms, based on, and this is extremely important, on clinical suspicion, because most patients come to the doctor between day 4 and 5 on average. That's the statistics.
Okay.
A patient is sick for a day or two. They think it's going to get better. It doesn't get better. On day 3, they call the doctor. They don't get an appointment right away usually. So day 4 or 5, they come to the doctor. And that's important, because if you look at the viral load pattern for COVID-19, the first 5 days, it's relatively, the viral concentration is very relatively flat. But around day 6, it explodes like a wildfire.
Okay.
So the key is to intervene before the infection gets out of control. The problem was that the testing that we were doing took 3 days to get back. So look, if a patient comes on day 5 and I do a test and I get the results on day 8, by the time the patient got the result, they were very, very sick. So I realized that waiting for the test results, waiting 72 hours, letting a patient go around and let their infection spread didn't seem like the right thing to do. So I started intervening based on clinical symptoms. I would do the testing as well, but that wasn't the reason for not to treat.
So you would begin your protocol and send the test in, I'm assuming, and then 3 days later, if it's something else, you would probably just stop the protocol. Is that essentially how you were approaching it?
It's a clinical decision, because the tests were not 100%. In other words, one-third of the time that the test said it's negative, it really was positive. So what I did was I used a case-by-case basis for every patient. It's a clinical decision.
Okay.
But the point was that and here's another aspect. It's been coined as a Lenko protocol, but let me define what that means. I didn't treat everyone. I looked at the statistics, and I realized that the young, healthy people defined as under the age of 60 with no medical problems, 99% of them got better without any intervention.
Right.
So it didn't seem necessary to treat them unless they got worse. But the high-risk population, where over the age of 60 with medical problems, or under the age of 60 with medical problems, or anyone that was short of breath, those people had a 5 to 10% chance of dying. Okay, if you look at the hospitals, if you look at the patients that were admitted and were on ventilators, these were the older patients with cancer, the patients with diabetes or heart disease, high blood pressure, and so on. Those are the patients that I picked, literally cherry picked, to treat, because those are the ones that I was concerned about were going to die. So by taking the high-risk patients, intervening within the first 5 days, and using a drug regimen in synergy, and let me tell you how it works. It's very interesting. Zinc is the virus killer. Zinc inhibits an enzyme called RNA-dependent RNA polymerase, or replicase. But anyway, that's an enzyme that lives inside a cell, and the virus uses that enzyme to make copies of itself and spread. And zinc inhibits the functioning of that enzyme. So basically, it stops the virus from growing or reproducing. The problem with zinc is it has trouble getting inside a cell. For biochemical reasons, zinc is an ion. It's like oil and water. The cell membrane is like oil, and the zinc is in water. So it has trouble getting inside the cell. So all hydroxychloroquine does in this context, it opens up a transport channel. It opens up a canal that lets the zinc go into the cell. And that's important because that's where the virus is, and that's where the enzyme is that the virus is using to grow. So by allowing the zinc to get inside the cell, it becomes an effective weapon in killing the virus. And the antibiotic was there for protecting the patient from pulmonary complications, protecting the patient from developing secondary bacterial pneumonias, which was the main cause why people were developing respiratory distress and acute respiratory distress syndrome and getting up on ventilators. So think of it this way. This is the analogy I started using, that zinc is the bullet. Hydroxychloroquine is the gun that shoots the bullet. And the azithromycin is the vest that protects the patient. So very elegant, very simple, very cheap. It costs $20, the whole treatment. One of the advantages of this approach is that it's pills. It's oral medication, which means patients could take it at home. If something's intravenous, for example, or even needs a shot, it becomes a logistical problem. How do we deliver this medication to a large group of people? So look at the perfect combination of characteristics. It's $20, and that's not a small thing. Because if we're going to scale something nationally or globally, it needs to be practical. It's, you know, the newer medications, which are very good, but they cost thousands of dollars. I mean, there's a realistic aspect here that you cannot scale that, you know, globally. So by having a cheap
medication. We think about Africa, we think about India, we think about all these third world nations. We want something that can really inhibit and stop this illness, and certainly for the acute conditions all over the world. And I my understanding is, in fact, you were just tweeting out last week that remdesivir is over $3,000. The other treatment that's being promoted by some physicians was celebrated by Anthony Fauci himself at one point, had felt like this was going to be very successful. Even if they were equally successful, a drug program that's $3,000 per patient would be very, very cost prohibitive across the world, would it not?
But there's much bigger issues with remdesivir. For example, its proven effectiveness is that it reduces the number of days of hospitalization. Listen carefully. It's only for patients in the hospital. It reduces on average from 15 days to 10 days. Which is not a small thing. I'm not saying that that's insignificant. However, it's only used in the hospital setting. My approach is keep the people out of the hospital.
How much success did you have keeping people out of the hospital?
So I saw 2,200 patients with COVID, COVID-19. Out of those 2,200 patients, we risk stratified them, and only 800 received the medication treatment. Because they were the ones that I deemed to be high risk. You would have expected a 5% mortality rate in this country. So you would have expected 40 deaths.
You would have expected 40 deaths. And how many deaths did you end up having?
Two.
I mean, that's a gigantic difference. What would be the arguments, or what arguments have you heard for your success rate? What are they saying why we can't trust Zelenko's protocol? I mean, is anyone pushing back against those numbers?
The debate is a ideological debate. It's a debate between, is empirical evidence or evidence, real world clinical evidence, valid medical information, or only data derived from a clinical trial considered valid? And this was there was an article printed in the New England Journal of Medicine earlier this year, where the conclusion was that only data derived from a clinical trial is considered valid, and anything outside of that is called quote unquote anecdotal. So my data, according to that definition, is anecdotal. But that's a big anecdote, I have to tell you, because if someone's drowning in the ocean and there's a piece of driftwood, I don't need a clinical trial to tell me that I should hold on to that driftwood. I may get a splinter, but I'm going to hold on to the best available option while I look for better things. So I'm not against clinical trials. Right. I'm just for common sense. For example,
right. Well, and you certainly don't wait and drown in the ocean while you wait for a study to tell you whether or not driftwood is floating as it appears to be floating. You go ahead and grab it because you're in an extreme situation. We are in the middle of an epidemic that every leading expert says they don't understand. Let's be honest. They're saying they don't understand it. They don't understand how asymptomatic carriers work. They don't understand who's giving it to who. One study will say asymptomatic carriers aren't spreading at all. Others will say they are the super spreaders doing it all. I mean, if you watch the news, you could not be more confused or be more sure that science is totally confused. So it seems to me, under those circumstances, with an illness no one understands, that, you know, let me just put it this way. If I am going to a doctor, I would hope that my doctor is attempting to use things that other doctors are saying they're having success with around the world. I do not want a doctor that is sticking to a protocol written by people that are admitting they are totally confused by the illness and are saying, just make them comfortable, you know, don't give them oxygen and stick them on a ventilator, which is killing, you know, 8 or 9 out of 10 of them. So you took a different approach. Now, how much have you had discussions with Didier Raoult or other doctors around the world that were using hydroxychloroquine? This is something that people, what you all question, right? How much interaction is there happening in science around the world? Do you guys talk to each other?
With Didier Raoult, I've been in contact indirectly via Twitter or emails and so on. I haven't spoken to him directly, but we have used each other's work to. He recently started using zinc, which was a derivative of my work. I was using hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin because of his work. See, medical knowledge is something that evolves with time. We're trying to discover what truth is, and it becomes clearer over time what the best approach is. By the way, I'm not saying that my approach is the best. It's very possible that in some period of time there'll be a better approach, and I would advocate for that. What I am saying is my approach is the only approach right now.
Right. Right. So you, and 2 deaths out of 800 that are in the high risk category is an incredibly good result, and I think one that we would all want. Let me ask you this. You know, as we've been watching this story, we watched the FDA, Donald Trump really pushed to get the FDA to give this, I think, emergency use approval. And it seems like nearly around the same time, many states pushed back. Now, I don't live in New York. It's hard to tell what really happened, but it felt like Andrew Cuomo really pushed back against hydroxychloroquine, and hospitals were sort of told, don't use this until really end stage. They're venting. We're in serious conditions. You know, you're in New York. What was sort of the overall feeling in hospitals around New York? Was it something everybody jumped to, or were people being told really hold off on the use of this drug?
So keep in mind, I practice exclusively in the not hospital setting, the outpatient setting.
Okay.
I can tell you from my perspective, patients were in terror because after the executive order basically limited the ability of patients to have access to this medication, except in the severely sick inpatient hospital setting, people started really panicking because they saw that it was working. It was word of mouth in their families and their friends and so on. So they started actually going to New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, and my patients started scrambling to get access to these medications. It was very sad, and it was unnecessary aggravation for patients. It interfered with the doctor-patient relationship, and it really created a barrier in the practice of medicine.
Did you get pushback? Were you called by anybody? Because you were pretty vocal, right? You were really out there as you were starting to see these rates. I mean, it seems like very early on, I heard about you all the way down here in Texas. So was anybody reaching out to you either from government or hospitals saying, you really need to cut this out, this is not the protocol we want to be using, and you're putting people at risk? Was there any sort of interactions like that, or did everyone just leave you alone?
Well, fortunately, I'm self-employed, so I don't have to answer to, I had my own practice, and I don't have to answer to any major hospital system. So I was able to practice medicine in the best way that I saw fit, and I had to answer only to myself and to God. So if the patient agreed and I thought it was appropriate, I would get the patient medication. And, you know, with experience, making the dosing, and I came up with the right dosing that minimizes minor side effects but has the maximum benefit. So patients were getting remarkable results very quickly, especially if you started within the first 5 days.
So Go ahead.
So I can understand why there was opposition to the use, because if there is a drug that a company is going to make $3,200 on if the patient's in the hospital, but they're not going to make that money if the patient is at home and healthy, so it's not good for the bottom line of that company. But it's good for the patient, and that's all I care about. You know, I'm trying to preserve the sanctity of human life. I saw so much death and so much misery, and people I know and friends and the pain of the human suffering, that I was just focused on, you know, let's just try to find an approach that works. Trial and error is really work, and you quickly adjust and tweak your.
Let's get into the details of the side effects. Well, first of all, Donald Trump ends up saying he likes hydroxychloroquine, and we saw almost an immediate, it was sort of a friendly, jovial confrontation, I guess we could say, between, you know, Tony Fauci and Trump. Trump saying, I got a really good feeling about this, and Fauci saying, I'd like to see more clinical trials, I'm not so sure. We've even reported on the fact, what was ironic about that moment is, when we later discovered that Tony Fauci knew that they had actually used hydroxychloroquine in studies all the way back with SARS coronavirus and had seen success, documented success as a potential for dealing with coronavirus all the way back in 2005. So I find it a little shocking that he was talking about it as though it was the first time and this was a brand new approach to coronavirus, when it really does date back, with there is some science that dates back quite a ways. But Donald Trump, you know, gets behind it. The FDA gives his emergency use. But then we start hearing about these side effects of heart attacks and things like that. And we've just found out really just a couple of weeks ago that there's two big studies that were begun, the Solidarity trial and the Recovery trial. One at World Health Organization had the Solidarity trial, and then the Recovery trial that I believe was at Oxford University. And an investigation into these trials that were supposed to be supposedly looking at this as a potential life-saving treatment, a great article in Age of Autism that got into this, found that they were using fatal doses of hydroxychloroquine in the neighborhood of 2,400 milligrams per day. First, since you actually work with it, to begin with, is it fair to call 2,400 milligrams per day a fatal dose? Do you think that is overdosing from your perspective?
Not if you're treating a very fat elephant.
Okay. I appreciate that answer.
I was using 400 a day.
400 a day. Okay. And I believe, if I'm correct, Dede Raiout is using somewhere around 600 milligrams of hydroxychloroquine per day. So because he wasn't using zinc.
If you use zinc, you need lower dosing.
Interesting. Okay, and so where did the zinc come from? Because we only heard the voice of Dede Raiout, there was azithromycin. Where did the zinc sort of enter the protocol? Did that come from a specific nation or scientist or doctor out there?
They were using it in the Far East, South Korea and China.
Okay.
And I saw those, some limited studies. It's more the basic science made sense. If the zinc is the virus killer, and you get the zinc to where the virus is, and it kills the virus, it makes sense. It's like a gun and a bullet. I mean, you need both. Having bullets without a gun or a gun without bullets is ineffective. When you have the combination of the two, then it works. So you don't need much of the hydroxychloroquine if you use zinc.
For people that aren't sick yet or are out there, you know, obviously we're hearing lots of discussions about this second wave that may be going on, whether or not that's just more testing or not. We could argue that. But for people that are worried, is there any benefit to taking zinc as a vitamin supplement right now? Or is it really only going to be valuable used the way that you're using it?
You're asking an excellent question, which is more about, is there any value to prophylaxis or prevention?
Right.
And the answer is yes. And I'm doing work on that right now. I personally take hydroxychloroquine and zinc I have some health issues. I have cancer. I have one lung. And I'm a doctor, and I come into contact with sick patients. So for that reason, to take hydroxychloroquine and zinc. And most of the smart doctors I know take it because they don't want to get sick and because it's so safe. So zinc alone probably has minimal benefit. You need to be able to get the zinc into the cell. There's another option, interestingly enough. It's a natural supplement called quercetin. Okay. And it seems to be a similar effect as hydroxychloroquine. So there's not much data on it, so I wouldn't advocate it. But however, if a patient cannot get hydroxychloroquine for whatever reason, or they can't take it for contraindications, I'll use that as plan B.
Got it. Okay, so now let me get into the problem we now have. We have a world divided over this issue, and really, it seemed to me hydroxychloroquine was just going to prove itself out. But because of these trials that are using lethal doses and a really bad study, really, that came out of the VA, where they looked at a very specific group of military people that were already, I think, being vented or in end stage, and they just showed that hydroxychloroquine didn't appear to work. No matter the case, there's been a really strong media push against it. Why do you think the media and everybody have been so prone to want to see hydroxychloroquine fail? What do you think is behind that? I mean, it's not just Gilead that we know could end up making $3,000 off of a product that can drop 5 days out of a 15-day stay at the hospital, but why is the media seeming to be gunning for it? And I would say, you know, even it seemed to me the moment Donald Trump said he liked it, that there was a real push to not like it. Do you feel like there's politics getting in the way of science right now? Or is it just money? What are your thoughts on that?
I think there are four reasons. I've thought through this. One is politics. The other is financial conflicts. The third is arrogance. And the fourth is fear. And I'll explain to you each one.
Okay.
Politics, we're right before a major election. I mean, this is probably one of the most important elections in the country's history. And if the president wins again, he'll probably shift the judiciary even more to the right. And, people that oppose him don't want that to happen. So there is a lot of political opposition, rightfully so, you know, this is a democracy, against the president. And since the president supported the hydroxychloroquine, and when it becomes public that it is the part of the solution to this pandemic, that's going to be a huge political win for the president. And it's also going to be a tool in expediting the opening of the economy, which is also a political win for the president. So I'm not making my own personal political viewpoint. I'm just giving you a political analysis of what I see.
Right.
So I've come across forces, political forces that I see that are willing to sacrifice life and let the economy burn in order to damage the chances of the president to get reelected.
Wow.
I do believe that. Number one. Number two, obviously, financial conflicts of interest are affecting the issue because the big pharmaceutical companies have invested billions of dollars. I have nothing against them, but they invested billions of dollars, and now medication that's off that's generic is going to put them out of business, essentially. You know, it's going to take away 95% of their market share, and they're not happy about that.
Right.
Three is the arrogance of the elite who have monopolized the flow of information. They feel only information through their hands is valid and can be used as a basis for treatment. And those physicians, like myself, front lines, dealing with life and death all the time, and our observations in their minds are not valid. And that's such a level of arrogance. Human history has evolved. We, as a human race, did not have clinical trials. We as a human race, learned through experience what works, what doesn't work, and what gave us a survival benefit we incorporated, and that which didn't died out. So what they're doing is not only against what human history has been like, but it's such a level of, I would even say corruption, because since they control the flow of the medical information, and as you know, you quoted the Solidarity trial and WHO and so on, you know, a lot of the recommendations of the WHO were based on fraudulent studies. The Lancet study that was, so you see this, such a tremendous amount of fraud.
You're talking about
corruption.
The Lancet study that was retracted, where we, you know, we had the Surgisphere, I believe it was called, a company that claimed to have all this data, but when they were asked to produce that data, they were unable to. It's really bad data and then bad information. So let me ask you this, you know, so we have this problem where we have these, you know, a small study, 800 people that you have, DDR-RAU is referred to 1,000 or so patients. Are there any nations that adopted hydroxychloroquine so that we can actually do a comparator in the middle of all of this mayhem? Are there any nations that did not push back against it that we could reference to see if, even though it's anecdotal, it surely gets to be more powerful? Anecdote becomes more and more powerful the larger the group of people involved in the anecdotal experience. Are there any nations that use hydroxychloroquine more than others, and what do we see there?
So I've personally been consulted by several governments, and I've given them my recommendations and my protocols. So, for example, the entire country of Honduras, let's say, are following the Zelenko protocol.
Okay.
And a large subsection of Brazil is following my protocol. There's a private health system called Prevent Senior, and they take care of around 500,000 senior citizens. And they're using my approach. And there are other hospitals, and they've seen a drastic drop-off in mortality rate. It's like an inflection point. The second they started using it, people stopped dying.
When did they start using it? If we look at their graphs, what date did they start using your protocol in Brazil?
I don't recall, but somewhere in the end of March, beginning of April, the Prevent Senior group. And then there were more other hospitals that came on board, which I don't remember exactly. But it was early.
We're looking at a graph right now from Brazil that really shows, you can see it was sort of plateaued at a top line there. And then it really starts dropping down at March 6th. And right now we see that for quite some time now, it's really been almost non-existent, the death rate, which is pretty impressive, especially when we're watching in America where we're not using it. We still see this, you know, we're still up there. We're watching death rates climb in certain states. Certainly infection rates are going up. What other countries? Are there other countries? So Honduras, Brazil, are there any others we can look to as we try to see our way through this?
Turkey is on board. Iran is on board. There's a city in the Ukraine that I'm actually leading their task force called Dnieper, and they're actually using prophylactic approach, and they're having tremendous success. I dealt with the Ministry of Health in Israel, and they started using it in at least in the hospital setting. Italy came on board. Italy had the worst death rate in the world, and then when they started using hydroxychloroquine, I actually gave an interview. I gave an interview to an Italian media outlet, probably the biggest one in the country. And 3 days later, there was an announcement that they started using hydroxychloroquine. And if you look at the graph, 3 days after that, their death rate started dropping.
Wow.
So there's a direct correlation. But I didn't need that. I saw with my own patients, when they stopped dying, I realized that, you know, death is bad and living is good. And I saw that it was very clear. That's why, you see, I made a video addressed to the President of the United States on YouTube. And the reason why I did it was that I felt like a frontline soldier that discovered an extremely important piece of intelligence. And I needed to report it to the five-star general, you know, so that he can win the war using that information. Because I realized the significance of what it was. So I made a video, and the next day, Mark Meadows calls me on my cell phone. And it's unbelievable. And he asked me what I was doing, and I told him. And then a few days later, Mayor Giuliani called me, and we did a podcast together, and that went viral. And then other news outlets started contacting me globally, actually, physicians, hospital systems. And I just started, whoever wants to talk to me, I would just give them that information. And more I saw it being used, the more I saw that people were having tremendous success from it. By the way, I'm not taking any credit for myself. I mean, I really believe that this was a gift from God. And it's not about me. It's about relieving the human suffering that is so unnecessary. People are not dying from COVID-19. They're dying by politics. It's called death by politics, death by stupidity. So we need to right now give priority to the sanctity of human life. And everything else is secondary. So,
agreed.
So let me give you an example. If Dr. Fauci is in Washington, D.C., and Washington, D.C. is being carpet bombed, let's say, would it make sense for Dr. Fauci to say that we need to do a study to see what kind of bullets work the best? It may take 4 months, but we have to do a study because the only clinical data like that matters. Right. Or would it rather make sense that we should use any bullets available? Right. It may not be the best bullets, but in parallel, do the studies. And if we find something better, then transition to that. But why would we not use the best available treatment in the short term? Why are we allowing the mass genocide of hundreds of thousands of people?
I agree. Did you have anything to do with Donald Trump taking hydroxychloroquine when he announced that to the nation?
It's hard for me to speak to the motives of someone else or the reasons why someone else does it. But I can tell you the facts. I sent a letter to the president, which is a matter of public record. And the letter outlined, it was in, I think, mid-April, I'm sorry. And it outlined my data at that point in time and my recommendations for treatment and for prophylaxis. And for prophylaxis, I wrote hydroxychloroquine and zinc. Okay. And during that news conference, when the president announced that he's taking hydroxychloroquine and zinc, he says, right after that, I got a letter from a certain doctor somewhere by Westchester, somewhere over there. And, you know, and he reported to me what he was seeing. He didn't want anything. He didn't want to come to that White House for dinner. He just wanted to say, Mr. President, this is what I'm seeing, and I think you should give a look into that. So I don't know. It seems that way, but I can't say for sure.
And now you have a study hot off the presses, is my understanding, that just came out. What is that study about? How's it different than, you know, what we've been watching in your previous work?
Well, actually, that study is reporting on my work. And, it was with my two colleagues, Dr. Derwin and Dr. Schultz, they're from Germany. And we really put thousands of hours into this. And what this study shows is, it's a subset of my patients. We only chose patients that had proven diagnosis by laboratory testing.
Okay.
Because it's difficult to, the medical community would not accept clinical diagnosis. The patient had the symptoms of COVID-19, would not be accepted. So for the purpose of establishing, it's a foundational study. It's the first study in the outpatient setting showing by risk stratifying patients and using a three-drug regimen, a reduction in hospitalization by 84%. My survival rate with my patients was 99.7.
Wow. And those were your high-risk patients, correct? The ones on the protocol?
Actually, that was all comers.
Okay. Now, what's amazing when I find ironic,
you know,
about
when you go to a doctor.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Part of the treatment is to know when not to treat. You know, a good surgeon knows when not to cut also. So when someone comes, the doctor has to make a decision. What is the most appropriate approach? And sometimes the most appropriate approach is to do nothing. So when someone comes in with COVID-19, you need to decide how best to approach this patient, who to give the medication to, who not to give the medication to. So that's also an important aspect of it. And my patients, the ones that I did not give the medication to, had 100% survival.
Wow. So that,
that means the criteria were correct. But for those patients that I did treat, we had a statistically significant difference.
In your patients
that you did treat,
did any of them have some of the heart complications we heard about? Did you have to back off on the treatment? I mean, is there some small issue there that maybe you did encounter dealing with some heart palpitations or things from the treatment?
All their hearts kept beating, and I saw no complications. And I, even furthermore, I actually spoke to the leading electrophysiologist. He's a cardiologist that specializes in QT prolongation. And I asked them, there are like 3,000 in the country, and they asked each other if anyone's ever seen complications with the use of hydroxychloroquine and zinc. And the answer was no. Here's the caveat. In the outpatient setting, they did see problems in the ICU setting, but then it's hard to know why, because COVID-19, 30% of patients with COVID-19 in the ICU develop heart damage from COVID-19. So
right.
It's difficult to know. But in the outpatient setting, which was the world that I was in, there was zero known complications. Listen, this drug has been around for 65 years, being used for multiple conditions. And even the people that were fear-mongering and saying, oh, it could kill you, simultaneously were saying, okay, if you have lupus, it's okay to take. The hypocrisy was difficult to tolerate.
Let me ask you, you know, and I really appreciate your time. I know you're very busy. How many times have you been asked by mainstream news agencies to discuss your protocol, whether it was a CNN, MSNBC, Fox? Are you doing a lot of interviews on this?
So CNN never contacted me. I've been Fox. I'm going to be on Fox, I think, very soon.
Okay.
But what you call the mainstream media has not reached out to me.
That seems incredible to me, given that you're sitting in the epicenter, not only of the United States, but perhaps the world, and having incredible results. I don't understand how reporters and news agencies aren't at least curious in asking you some questions. How do you think history is going to look back at this, the events of this pandemic, in relationship to hydroxychloroquine? When we sort of have more of a bird's eye view of what took place here, who should worry about how they're going to go down in history?
So my personal opinion is anyone who got in the way of access to care, who got in the way of access to patients having medication, committed crimes against humanity and are guilty of mass murder.
That is as powerful statement as can be made. Dr. Zelenko, I want to thank you for your courage. I want to thank you for your diligence. I think you represent what we all hope every doctor has, which is a curiosity and a desire to, you know, do what is necessary to save their patients. You're having a better success rate than almost anyone else in this country, certainly in many places around the world. Those that are following your protocols are seeing incredible gains. Here at the High Wire, we have continued this story. We will continue to watch this story. I believe that you are correct. I believe people are being needlessly murdered by being denied really the only treatment that has shown success in multiple regions of the world, in multiple different scenarios. So keep up the good work, and we look forward to tracking your future work, and I hope that we can have you on the high wire again soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and God bless you.
If you liked that clip, then be sure to check out our live broadcast of The High Wire every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. Pacific time. You can watch it on Facebook, YouTube, iTunes, and Twitter. We'll see you there.